Case this morning is State v. Scanlon.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Collins here on behalf of Teresa Scanlon, who's here in the audience today. And I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. The complaining witness in this case declined to testify against Ms. Scanlon at trial. The prosecution instead relied on his out-of-court statements to police and medical professionals as the sole evidence of what happened. When the prosecution shields the complaining witness from adversarial testing, and out-of-court statements are treated as the functional equivalent of his testimony, this undermines an accused person's right to confront witnesses against him or her and the fair opportunity to defend herself. The statements here are testimonial because they were given to police and to medical professionals in the course of an ongoing prosecution and an active police investigation of past crime.
Are all the statements necessarily testimonial?
Yes, we believe that they are, both to the hospital providers as well as the Virginia Mason providers, looking at all the relevant circumstances that we have present in this case. It's very much like Hurtado, where the police officer was actually in the room because of the information that had been given, even though the police officer wasn't personally present. It was as if the detective was, because Mr. Bagnell knew that all that information would be obtained by and not only the police but also the prosecutor.
Are you still arguing the officers' testimony themselves, Geiger and Brusella's testimony?
That's classically testimonial. That was information. The harmless error test applies, of course, to that, but it's clearly testimonial. It was information that Ms. Scanlon had already been arrested. It's very much like in Davis versus Washington, the Hammond case, the companion case to Davis, where the police arrive to determine what happened. The husband and wife in Hammond are both at the scene. The police separate them and ask the wife what happened. And that was testimonial, the U.S. Supreme Court said, because the crime was over. It wasn't a cry for help. There wasn't who did what. We have to find out the perpetrator and assess what happened. The crime is complete. Ms. Scanlon was in custody, had been arrested.
But these are statements, at least some of them, or many of them, were made to medical professionals in the course of treatment.
Yes.
And those are recognized by the Supreme Court as a little bit different than communications with police officers.
Yes. And there's case law in Washington addressing this scenario, and the Hurtado case is one of them that comes from this court, which said you look at whether a reasonable person in the declarant's position would anticipate his or her statement being used against the accused in investigating and prosecuting the alleged crime. And here, the circumstances that we look at here are, first, there was a pending prosecution for a similar assault allegation that happened a few weeks earlier, where the complaining witness had been present at Ms. Scanlon's arraignment, knew that there was a no-contact order issued, and actually asked the court not to impose one, but the court had imposed a no-contact order. This no-contact order that he received says that any contact is a crime. So knowing that, Mr. Bagnell had also signed, before this incident happened, a detailed release form giving the police and the prosecutor access to medical records and investigating that offense.
Was that access to medical records surrounding the October offense?
That was surrounding the October offense, but he understood. It wouldn't have directly applied, but it does inform the information that would be available to a person in his position, which is that the police do actively obtain and talk to medical professionals and get those records.
So a reasonable person, though, he's going into the ER, and the first person he sees is an ER nurse, then an ER doctor. And a reasonable person is expecting the statements to them are going to be used for prosecution? Isn't it treatment?
You look at all the circumstances. Before he was interviewed, before he was taken to the hospital, he had been interviewed by the police at the scene, at his home, and interviewed and photographed. Then he was transported to the hospital, and the hospital personnel talked to him and not only about his injuries, but also about whether the police are involved in this, whether there's no contact, or they take photographs, they're collecting evidence. There's a degree of investigation to those interactions as well, and as well as a degree of formality, and of course, he does understand at that point that information would be transported or transferred all over to the police. The police come to the hospital, obtain another release form, the same very detailed, very explicit release form that we are investigating, that we will be gathering all information for any prosecution.
They get that at 1 in the morning?
After he's spoken to the doctor and the nurse and social worker at the hospital, yes. And then you have a week later, the detective comes to Mr. Bagnell's home, gets another release form because the detective has already spoken to the doctor, says, I know that you have another medical appointment. The Dr. Britt told me that you do, and we need another release form that's going to apply to these future appointments. So he goes to all those Virginia Mason appointments, knowing that the police not only are permitted to access his records, but are accessing his records. And as that release form says, in furtherance of an investigation and any prosecution, which under this unusual circumstance, with all that, the array of information, it is very unlike that Ohio versus Clark case, for example, where a preschool teacher notices bruises on a child and says, what happened? Who did this to you? Before any police are involved, before there's when they're still trying to determine whether this is an ongoing concern of a problem, an assault problem that will be continuing. There's no police involvement whatsoever in that case. And in that case, that was not testimonial, but this is very much like the Hurtado case or the Hammond case from Davis versus Washington, where a reasonable person...
Even under all these other circumstances, wouldn't a reasonable person going into the ER November 6th have the reasonable expectation that their communications with their physician and the AR would be confidential until and unless he signed a new release, which he didn't do until after he spoke with three?
Well, he did understand that the police are gathering this type of information for prosecution, and there was already a pending prosecution, and this would conceivably be relevant to that no contact order that was violated, and that there isn't an active prosecution that's going on, and he has full knowledge that another prosecution will be going on based upon this information, which makes it unusual. And I also just want to submit that in Sandoval, that test that we used in Hurtado, which doesn't say just because a statement is made for diagnosis and treatment, we say it's never testimonial. They say you also have to look at whether there's an indication the witness expected the statements to be available for use at trial. And under that prong, Sandoval and Hurtado acknowledge that just because there is medical personnel or purposes involved doesn't mean it's not testimonial.
May it please the Court, Anne Summers on behalf of the State of Washington. Applying the framework that's been set forth by the United States Supreme Court, the victim's statements to medical providers were not testimonial. We know now that it's the primary purpose test that applies to these statements based on that, and that test has been set forth in Michigan v. Bryant and Ohio v. Clark. The court looks objectively at the circumstances of the encounter to determine what the primary purpose of the encounter was. And quoting Bryant at page 358, if after considering all the relevant circumstances, the primary purpose of the statement is something other than a desire to create a record for trial, the statement is non-testimonial. Looking at Ohio v. Clark at page 2182, quote, statements made to someone who is not principally charged with uncovering and prosecuting criminal behavior are significantly less likely to be testimonial. Now, the fact that this is entitled the primary purpose test is acknowledgement that statements can sometimes have multiple purposes. So the fact that medical personnel have knowledge that sometimes the statements they gather, the information they gather, can be used in criminal prosecution does not alter the primary purpose of their interaction with their patient. And that's just like Ohio v. Clark, where you have the preschool teacher who's aware of mandatory reporting, who intends to report any evidence of abuse to authorities, the preschool teacher who's talking to the 3-year-old child. Nonetheless, in Ohio v. Clark, and this is at 2183, the court said it is irrelevant that the teacher's questions and their duty to report the matter had the natural tendency to result in Clark's prosecution. The fact is the primary purpose of that conversation between the preschool teacher and the 3-year-old child was to figure out what had happened to this child so that she can make sure he was safe and would receive whatever treatment he needed. Whether he was injured, whether he needed medical treatment, whether he could be safely released to his home. And likewise here, the evidence is that neither the victim or the medical providers had the primary purpose of assisting in the prosecution here. Their primary purpose was to determine how Mr. Bagnell got these extensive injuries and how to treat them. And, of course, with a person of Mr. Bagnell's age, when you have all this extensive bruising, there's lots of reasons why you could have – it could be a medical – a medication problem causing the bruising. It could be a medication problem that he's been rendered unconscious and he's falling a lot causing the bruising, or it could be from an assault. And it's very important for the medical providers to obtain that information to figure out how to treat these injuries and how to protect Mr. Bagnell from future harm.
Wouldn't Mr. Bagnell, though, I mean – back to the defense's argument, wouldn't he know that, or wouldn't he expect that some of what they were asking him was for investigative purposes? He did know there was an ongoing investigation, a no-contact order. He'd already talked to the police.
Yes. But that doesn't matter. That's not determinative. And it's important for this court to realize that the declarant-centric test that Washington courts have been applying in Sandoval and Hurtado prior to Ohio v. Clark is not the test. There was some, I mean, we were all kind of confused about what the test was for testimonial. And when you read those cases, the court seemed to believe that the primary purpose test only applies to statements to police officers. So they actually say in Hurtado, we're applying the primary, we would apply the primary purpose test to statements to police officers, but when they're statements to someone other than a police officer, we apply this declarant-centric test. Well, clearly that's not the proper standard after Ohio v. Clark. It is simply the primary purpose test. And so, and under that...
Is there a different result under Sandoval?
Yes, yes. Because one of the factors that the court in Sandoval had pulled out in this declarant-centric test is that there's no indication that these statements would be used for prosecution. Well, that can't stand scrutiny after Ohio v. Clark, because clearly the preschool teacher had every indication that these statements might well be used for prosecution. But the court nonetheless said the primary purpose of that encounter was not to gain evidence for a prosecution.
So in this case, applying Ohio, mm-hmm. you would say that all statements to by the declarant are not testimonial? Both those before the release and those after
yes.
the release?
Yes. Certainly the statements to the emergency room, people in the emergency room, that was an ongoing emergency there because they needed to figure out why this bruising had occurred and what to do about it. The follow-up appointments to his primary care physician and to the wound care specialist, I think it's important. One of the important factors here is that Mr. Bagnell's wounds were not healing. So that appointment was important for him getting further medical treatment because as the wound care specialist testified, at that point you need to figure out is there some medical reason why, medication type reason why the wounds aren't healing? Is there some self-harm going on here why the wounds aren't healing? So that follow-up appointment was not simply to gather more evidence for prosecution. Those follow-up appointments were for purposes of medical treatment, both from the provider's standpoint and from the victim's standpoint.
But at that point, the officers had revisited him, told them they needed another release for...
Yes, but the medical release forms are not determinative, just the same way that the mandatory reporting laws in Ohio are not determinative. That fact alone doesn't make the primary purpose of the encounter different. And I think it's important to realize about these medical release forms. The purpose of the medical release form is not to obtain medical records that can then simply be provided as the evidence at trial. The purpose of the medical release forms is for the prosecution to get the medical records to be able to determine the level of injury so we can make the decision as to what level of assault needs to be charged based on the level of injury. Is it great bodily injury? Is it substantial bodily injury? Is it something less than that? It's for us to identify the medical witnesses that will come in and testify to the level of injury. It's to provide those records to the defense under our Brady obligations.
But it's also to provide, and in this case, it's to provide the name of the person he said did it.
Yes, but we already had that from the victim and from the circumstances. So the idea that the whole purpose of the medical release forms were to...
The victim didn't testify.
Yes, but that was not... Even at the beginning of trial, we thought the victim might be testifying, and that's clear. There's a statement but they're saying, well, we don't know whether Mr. Bagnell's going to be here or not. So this was one of those domestic violence prosecutions where it was a bit of an open question.
If I understood your briefing... you argued in the alternative, even under the Sandoval standard, you prevail?
Yes.
Do you want to elaborate a little?
Well, I think the defense tried to rely on Hurtado, where the police officers were present. And the Hurtado court said, well, if the police officers are present during the interview between the medical provider and the patient, then that makes it a testimonial. I think that is incorrect now after Ohio v. Clark. But even if that was still a correct statement of the law, the evidence here was that the police were not around for these interviews. These were just I shouldn't call it interviews. For this interaction between the medical providers and the victim, it was just them in the room. And the focus of the questions was clearly to treat Mr. Bagnell for his extensive injuries.
If we followed Hurtado and Sandoval and found the statements made prior to the release, do we have error here?
I'm sorry, can you ask that again?
Do we have harmless error? Or
If the statements, I'm sorry, do I understand your question? If the statements in the emergency room come in and the statements after the emergency room, I do think you have harmless error. Because the most important statements were the statements to the nurse that, in fact, Ms. Scanlon was the person who assaulted him, and then also the statement to Dr. Britt, that goes to the unlawful imprisonment charge. And then the other statements to his primary care physician, Dr. Indow, and then to the wound specialist, those are cumulative as far as, because the only link it provided was who did this, right? And that comes from the nurse's testimony, the ER nurse's testimony. So I think it would be harmless error. So I do think part of their argument in the reply brief seems to be that any time police have been called, once police have been called, any subsequent statements to medical providers are somehow now testimonial. And I just don't think that is a correct statement of the law, certainly under the Ohio v. Clark standard. And the logic doesn't really stand up if, after all, statements to police officers themselves can be non-testimonial under the primary purpose test. Then the mere fact of police involvement in the case can't make statements testimonial. It is the primary purpose test. This court objectively views all the relevant circumstances of the encounter between the declarant and the person they were talking to, and here those objective circumstances show that these statements were non-testimonial. Thank you.
The constitutional harmless error test that applies to the Confrontation Clause violation is not, well, some statements were cumulative. It's this prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that none of the errors contributed to the verdict. And certainly,
question: if we were to say that the statements to the ER providers prior to the release came in and everything subsequent to the release didn't, can you address the error?
The Virginia Mason providers were critical to first the unlawful imprisonment allegations and to the second-degree assault allegations because they've repeatedly, Stacey Friel and Dr. Pierce, talk about being hit with these implements over multiple areas, being locked in a room. That was critical testimony to establish these particular charges and the severity of them. So their testimony was very important and certainly would have been relied on by jurors, which is why the error can't be harmless, and you can stop by it here and simply only reaching the Virginia Mason providers and finding those to be testimonial. You don't even need to go further to reverse.
But he did tell Dr. Britt that he'd been imprisoned and hadn't been fed.
But again, the constitutional harmless error test, it is not just did he say that one time and then is that repeated. The accumulation would certainly bolster it to the jury, in addition to the details he provided to several providers of Virginia Mason. The state
counsel, in your reply brief, you say that Ohio versus Clark is not dispositive precedent. The state seems to think it is. Why isn't it dispositive?
Well, it's not dispositive because it's addressing a very different circumstance. I mean, I'm not saying that the test isn't applicable. It certainly is. They say look at all relevant circumstances. There's nothing that's determinative, certainly. And looking at all the relevant circumstances, this case is so far different from Ohio versus Clark.
So its application
Yes, I'm not saying that the test wouldn't apply. Certainly, this you look at the scenario, but it's completely consistent. Ohio versus Clark's announced the test certainly out of Davis versus Washington and out of Michigan versus Bryan. We're not challenging the test, although the Hurtado test is completely consistent with it as well. Hurtado says when that prong of Sandoval about whether the witness expected the statements to be used, Hurtado explains that's a reasonable person in the declarant's position. It's an objective test. You don't look, as the state's trying to argue, what the doctor wanted, the purposes of the question. You don't look, what did Mr. Bagnell, what was he trying to do? You look at an objective person, but in his position and knowing all the information that he knew. And in this case, the prosecution barely tried to bring Mr. Bagnell to court. They simply went to his house during the trial, and he declined to take a ride to court when offered by the detective. And Ms. Scanlon was unable to contest those allegations that were false and that were exaggerated. She couldn't offer evidence that he had written her an apology letter. She couldn't explore his biases. She couldn't document how she acted in self-defense. The forensic pathologist indicated in his testimony that his injuries could be explained in part by her trying to push against him when he admitted that he had been restraining her. He was unable to show. Mr. Bagnell came to sentencing and said he had actually left the house during the incident and walked away. She couldn't prove her defense. She couldn't challenge the accusations because he didn't come to court. And this court should find those testimonial statements required in the trial. Thank you.